Whatever reader ritual Lucan had used to mute sound, it had either worn off or vanished in the presence of Nekothi's heart. She caught snippets of his conversation.
Getting dangerous. Can't stay. Do it now. Joran will...
His voice faded, but it sounded as though he was lecturing someone, and she thought she heard him mention Joran. That could be Joran Cursebreaker, the regent of the South who had taken over after the Emperor's death. He'd built the original system of prisons under this island, Lucan had told her, though the cells in which they now rested were new additions. Why would they need a regent to get involved? Was he supposed to do something about the heart? Of course, it could be any other of the 100,000 people with his name. Heroes of imperial legend tended to have whole generations of people named after them, so it couldn't be uncommon. A woman responded. Jerry couldn't make out many details, but the response was flat.
Not sure you should, Lucan said. It wants... here. That's more... afraid to...
The woman raised her voice so Jerry could hear her clearly.
We have to do something. The entire island is in danger.
And Jerry finally recognized the woman's voice. Shara. He was talking to the would-be assassin who had taken Jerry here in the first place. She pressed herself harder against the back wall. As much as the heart's presence frightened her, the idea of Shara remembering her scared her more. What if Shara had only let her live this long as an oversight? And now, on the eve of Jerry's escape, the woman had finally remembered? Jerry clutched the iron band so hard that it stabbed into the flesh of her palm. As she'd suspected, the metal had warmed up after an hour or two, and ever since it was safe to touch, Jerry had worn it against her skin. She was terrified to lose it, worried that she would miss her opportunity, scared that she might not get to fight for her freedom. It was strange, she thought. She was looking forward to the fight itself more than to the freedom. What did that say about her?
That I've been locked up in here for too long, probably.
A figure in black moved outside the bars of Jerry's cell, and Shara stepped up, watching Jerry curiously. The terror gripped Jerry's heart in panic. Would it be now? Would Shara correct her mistake here? She clutched the metal band tighter, such that she was afraid she might draw blood. The heart's power had remained steady, so there was no signal, but she could try using the Elder artifact anyway. Maybe it would still work and free her, though it would likely anger the sleepless. If Shara entered, she would try it. What did she have to lose? But the consultant didn't say anything. She stood there, watching. After a few awkward moments, Jerry forced herself to her feet, slipping the iron band on her left wrist and casually holding the arm behind her back. The artifact was a little loose to be worn as jewelry, but hopefully Shara wasn't here for a detailed inspection. With her other hand, Jerry combed her hair back as though that were the most important thing on her mind. It may have been too late to start playing the cool, unemotional prisoner after she had cringed and shrunk against the wall the second Shara showed up, but every bit of poise would help.
Shara, isn't it? May I help you with something?
Shara was silent for another second before she spoke.
Why do what you're doing? What is the point?
Far from sounding cold and collected, she sounded weary. That surprised Jerry more than the assassin showing up in the first place. The last time the two had spoken, the other woman had sounded as though she had a jagged black rock where her heart should be.
I'm stuck in a cell, sleeping 12 hours a day,
Jirene responded.
Just trying to while away idle hours, I suppose. Not much point to it.
Shara sagged forward, resting her forehead against the bars.
I don't want to do this. Elders and emperor and living forever. Any of it. I just... well, that's the way it is. So I at least want to know why. What are you doing this for? What's the point?
Jerry studied her for a moment. Shara looked as though she hadn't slept for a week and spoke like someone about to die. This was the ideal moment to offer hope.
Humans are fundamentally selfish, aren't we?
Jerry said.
No matter what else we do, when it comes down to a moment for action, we will always act for ourselves. We spend our whole lives worshipping one person.
Shara didn't react. She didn't leave or argue either, which Jerry took as a good sign.
And where has that gotten us? Everyone agrees that it would be better if we were more charitable, more virtuous, nicer to our fellow man. But we don't change. We advance, we make discoveries, but the basic nature of humanity remains the same throughout the centuries.
Jerry held up one finger.
There is only one truly selfless act, and that is anything done in the service of humanity as a whole. For all mankind, for everyone, present and future, whether or not we ever see a benefit for ourselves.
Forcing herself to maintain a calm facade, Jerry stepped forward and gripped the bars, holding herself face to face with a woman who had taken her captive.
The Sleepless do not worship elders. We're not a cult, nor do we capture and examine them ourselves like the Black Watch do. Our goal is to communicate with the great elders, to establish a common understanding so that we can benefit from just the tiniest fraction of their wisdom. Not for ourselves, you understand. For all mankind.
Jerry finished the speech with a smile.
That's not so bad, is it?
Shara leaned back from the bars. She loosened her arms, rolling her neck, rubbing her shoulders as though she had just woken up. And after a few seconds, she spoke.
You're idiots. Thanks. That's what I wanted to know.
With her right hand, the consultant reached behind her back and pulled out one of her bronze blades. Jerry stepped back, gripping the icy band of iron. Her palms were wet and clammy, and her breath was coming fast. Would she be able to complete the summons before Shara opened the door and used the knife? Would the call even work? But Shara didn't open the door. Her gaze lingered on Jerry for another instant before she moved off down the hall toward Lucan's cell. She had only taken one step when she stopped and fell into a crouch. Lucan's voice drifted from the next door.
"Who are you?"
he asked someone Jerry couldn't see.
"What are you doing here?"
And another voice, a familiar voice, echoed through the stone hallways.
"On your knees," Calder said.
Calder had rehearsed his next confrontation with Shara, but it didn't go as well as he'd hoped. When he and his consultant escorts had turned the corner in the dungeon and seen Shara in the hallway, he had an instant of pure joy. He was still wearing the Emperor's crown after all, so he ordered her down on her knees. Everyone in the hallway knelt on command, with a few notable exceptions. Calder himself remained standing, of course, as did Andal and Foster. The man in the cell to the left, some half-Heartlander man with a cell full of books, remained seated normally. And Shara stayed where she was, balanced on the balls of her feet with a knife in her right hand.
"Shara, I order you to put down the knife," Calder said.
It might have been his imagination, but he thought he saw her hand tremble. She didn't release the knife, though.
"There, you see?" Foster said. "That's all it should do. It's been working too well."
"Where did you get that?"
Shara asked. Her voice had gone cold, and her eyes locked on his head. Before he could answer, he was drawn to his left, to the cell in which the Heartlander man sat on a cot. He hadn't noticed before, preoccupied as he was with Shara, but there was something in that cell.
"It wants Calder dead. It wants to use his body as raw materials to build him up into a monstrous slave. It wants to tear apart and remake him. It wants..."
Calder tore his mind away, trying not to look at the box in that man's hands. Though he was in a cage, he held the source of that malicious intent. The heart of Nakothi had only grown stronger since Calder had last seen it. Now he was more resolved to keep it away from anyone who wanted to use it. At this rate, no one would be able to resist Nakothi's will for long. The man in the prison held up the box in one hand.
"What do you intend to do with this?"
he asked. Calder started to answer, but the other man didn't wait. He hurled the box out between the bars. Calder reached out to catch it, but he was too slow. Shara had already plucked it from the air and vanished into the deeper shadows of the tunnel, as though she had melted into darkness. The exchange happened so quickly that it left him reeling. By the time he recovered, only a second later, he could hear nothing of Shara. She may as well have become a shadow herself. But he had shadows of his own.
"Get Shara. Bring me the box," he ordered.
Instantly, all the consultants dashed down the tunnel after her. In a breath, the hall was empty of everyone who could be commanded by the crown. Calder stepped up to the bars, flanked by Andal and Foster.
"And who might you be, sir?"
The prisoner leaned back against the wall, pulling a glove on.
"Call me Lucan. You're Calder Martin, I presume."
"It seems I'm famous.
You asked me a question a moment ago, and I thought I'd hear your answer first. What do you intend to do with a heart?
An answer for an answer. You tell me where you got that crown, and I will tell you about the heart.
Fair enough, and all Calder had to do was sit and wait for the consultants to return with Shara in tow. He could give Lucan just enough details to keep him interested without giving him the actual truth. He couldn't tell a stranger the full story, after all. There was too much to incriminate him. But a woman called out from farther down the tunnel.
Calder, are you there?
Behind him, Andal drew in a sharp breath, and Foster muttered something unkind. Calder barely heard them. He drifted past Lucan's cell to a second. This one was identical in construction, if not in contents. One wall of bars with a door, three stone walls and a dirt floor, a cot and a small table visible from the hall. Lucan's had overflowed with books, papers, and extra small possessions, as though he had been living there for years and had slowly made the place his own. By comparison, this cell was bare, stark, and Jerry was in it. She wore the standard red shirt and pants provided to Imperial prisoners, the same clothes Calder's father had worn the last time he'd seen the man. Seeing the clothes on Jerry felt like a scene out of a nightmare. Her hair was messy and unbraided, as though she'd just woken up, and she hurriedly brushed her fingers through it when she saw him. Other than that, she was in better condition than he'd hoped. Unbroken skin, no wounds, no signs of deprivation or abuse. They must have questioned her, surely, but no one had forced any answers out of her. Good. She was in perfect condition to answer to him. Or she would be, if he could figure out what to say. Sheer relief at seeing her safe stole his breath, and every question died on his tongue. Why didn't you tell me? When did you become a soulbound? If I get you out of here, will you tell me everything? In the silence, Andal took over.
Jyreen, you're looking better than I expected.
Andal, you look exactly the same.
There was a half smile on her face, as though they'd met again on the deck of the Testament.
Foster, I see you're still alive.
Foster barked a laugh, but otherwise he kept silent, no doubt waiting for Calder to take the lead.
Should I let you out of here? Calder asked at last.
Andal and Foster must have taken that as their cue to exit. One of them moved down the tunnel and into the shadows, and the other back by Lucan's cell. Presumably they were doing it to keep watch, but Calder knew they were trying to give him some space to talk. Calder watched Jerry as she switched expressions between pleading, angry, proud, and troubled in the space of an instant. She was trying to decide which face to show him. Trying to decide which emotion she felt the strongest, maybe. Finally, she settled on tired.
I would very much like to get out of here.
I want to take you, he said. And he meant it. He hated seeing her like this, but that wasn't enough. I have to know it's safe. How long have you been a soulbound? Her eyes fixed on the wall behind him.
Virtually my entire life. My father made me help slaughter an elder-tainted baby Chimera when I was little more than 4 years old. Its alchemically preserved heart became the jewel in one of the earrings. The other is a copy. I wore those earrings for years before I had enough of a bond to awaken them.
That was more or less what he'd expected, though it still burned him worse than he'd thought to be hearing a new story out of a woman he'd known for more than 10 years, a woman who knew everything about him. He stopped himself before he went too far down that path and left her here out of pain and spite.
And the cult?
It's not a cult,
she said, as though begging him to believe her.
My father was one of the sleepless leaders. He had to leave the Black Watch because some of his fellow guild members were getting too suspicious. We think he was eventually killed on a mission in the Aeon, but we don't know for sure.
He was getting closer to the answers he really wanted and feared, as though he were circling the edges of a hungry whirlpool. And what did they have you do?
Practically nothing. We were barely in contact.
Calder reached through the bars to see if he could read her motivations. More importantly, he'd be able to hear a lie before it formed. She recoiled as though he'd extended a weapon. Tell me the truth, Jerry. She hesitated, looking around for a way out. After a few seconds of stalling, she hesitantly clasped his hand. From here, he could read her current intent. She was frightened, focused on escape, tired, and, surprisingly,
overjoyed to see him again. When he felt that, his heart melted. He almost pulled her out of the cell right then. But there was more. She also felt an old, worn guilt and something else. She was focused on hiding something here, now, something that she desperately hoped he didn't notice.
"My mother was worthless after my father disappeared," she went on. "The Sleepless raised me. They saw to my training and to my education. When I was old enough, they started sending me places."
"Where?" he asked, though he thought he knew.
"Also Greyweather's home. They wanted me to study with the Black Watch."
Her intent was pure, straightforward. At the moment, she intended nothing but the truth. He closed his eyes against a returning wave of anger. So everything, from the first day, had been engineered. "Andal warned me," he reminded himself. "You don't really know her," he said. "Don't marry her." I told him he didn't know what he was talking about. Yet another time he'd gotten himself into trouble by ignoring Andal's advice.
"You have to understand, Calder," she said desperately. "We're not trying to destroy the world or whatever the Emperor told everyone. The Elders have so much wisdom to share, so much power. If we can establish a working relationship with them, like you have with Shuffles and the Lyathaton, then we can't imagine everything we could learn. This world is only..."
It was too painful to listen to her. She actually believed everything she was saying, so he cut her off with another question. "After that, after we met, what was your second assignment?" For a moment, she intended to refuse him an answer, simply out of irritated anger. But then she smoothed it out and looked at him openly.
"They wanted me to help you break your father out of prison."
True. Her intent remained clear.
"But it wasn't just them,
And the Testament? Was that their idea?" She hesitated, but he felt the truth.
"They wanted the ship out of Blackwatch hands. I said we could steal it."
Calder remembered Jerry pushing for him to steal the Testament. He had wanted to try breaking his father out without the ship, but it had been Jerry who talked him into the theft in the first place. He'd thought it was because she wanted a more exciting story. Now he knew. She rushed to explain.
"They wanted to take it from you, but I wouldn't tell them where we were. And when they found out you'd made a bargain with Calorak, they worshipped you. Someone with a link to a bellowing horror, a Lyathaton, and the Soul Collector himself. They couldn't have begged for anyone more perfect. Some of them wanted to make you Emperor, Calder."
He found himself squeezing her hand painfully hard before he realized it. So, he'd made an Elder cult happy, had he? "Did they ask you to marry me?" he asked, finally. She hesitated.
"I wanted to," she said. "Calder, I do love you."
Her intent was off, not entirely straight. She was leaving something out. "Did they ask?" She trembled as though trying to push the words down before they could come out.
"Yes. They wanted me to, but only so I could teach you, so I could show you the truth. They hated the Emperor, too, and they wanted you to get the crown."
He had released her already and started walking out. "Foster, Andal," he called. They hurried behind him, neither of them saying a word.
"Please don't leave me here,"
Jerry shouted. He stopped in his tracks for a second, letting everything he wanted to say run through his head in an incomprehensible jumble. Finally, he just left. Jerry fought back the tears, not for her own sake, but because she didn't want Lucan to hear her crying. It was a strange sort of vanity, and she knew it didn't make any sense. He had just heard their whole discussion, after all, and they were both prisoners. But she couldn't bear the thought that he, a stranger, would listen to her weeping in her cell. There was one good thing that had come of Calder's visit, she reminded herself. He had been so focused on his questions and on their relationship that he hadn't inspected her poorly fitting alien bracelet. The iron band didn't feel strange anymore, but she was confident that if Calder had read it, he would have known far more about its purpose than she did, and he would have interfered somehow. Not that she would have minded much if he had. Doing what the Sleepless told her typically ended with her in a more miserable situation than before. Jerry gripped the metal. She had to break out of here before the Testament left the island. If she forced her way on board, she was sure that she could explain herself. She had done everything with pure motives, after all. Calder couldn't deny that. He would be able to sense as much. They could work through this. She looked forward to seeing him realize that she was in the right all along, and that he had actually abandoned her, not the other way around. No matter how it had turned out, she was still glad that the truth was out there after so many years. She didn't need to hide anymore. She could openly persuade him to her cause. But part of her wanted him to forget everything. Wanted to forget everything herself so that the two of them could live as navigators and let the Elders and the Black Watch do whatever they wanted. She shook herself back to reality. No matter how it turned out, she had to break out of here before Calder's ship left the dock. She would count to 500, slowly. It would take Calder at least that long to get back to his ship if he headed straight there, and she was sure he would waste time looking for the heart. If the signal didn't come before she was done counting, she was sending the summons anyway. It was past time that she checked out. Chapter 23. Present Day. When the whispered song of the heart led Nabarius to an abandoned, empty meadow, he wondered if he'd misheard. There was nothing here but grass, flowers, and boulders that littered the meadow as though they'd been scattered by a giant child playing with a handful of marbles. He stood there for over 15 minutes, waiting by the boulder and listening to the reassuring sound of the heart's whispers before he noticed the battle. A black-clad shape darted from one boulder to another, holding a steel blade in its hand. He moved to investigate and glimpsed a fleeing figure carrying a bronze knife. Shara. She disappeared behind a tree, and he heard nothing. Maybe the occasional scuffle, but no clang of metal on metal, no grunt of a man suffering a wound. He hurried over, checking behind the tree, and saw nothing but a few broken branches on a bush. Maybe they had moved on.
Stay, stay, stay and be reborn, the song crooned.
He stayed where he was. Only a moment later, a box tumbled out from between two boulders. Blood had splattered one corner of the box, and it was open slightly. The song leaked from within. A joyous smile spread over Nabarius' face, and he reached into the box, cradling the heart like an infant.
Run, said Nakothi's heart, while you sing back to me. Run.
He stumbled through the undergrowth, focusing all his attention on the heart in his hands, trying to get the barest sliver of a grasp on its infinite, ancient intent. It was made for a purpose far beyond anything he could comprehend, but he had to understand at least a fraction of its significance. Otherwise, it would never awaken. Calder emerged from the concealed tunnel entrance leading to the dungeons, stalking his way through the forest with Andal and Foster behind him. He couldn't seem to think straight anymore. Now, all he wanted to do was leave. He'd found out the truth about Jerry, and Nabarius had run off. That much was a relief. Now that the Chronicler was gone, someone else could deal with him. Maybe the consultants would kill him. Maybe he would escape, but Calder didn't care. The heart was important, to the world and to Calder's future. Anyone who held it could make a case for the Emperor's throne and thus get in Calder's way. He couldn't live in a world with a second Emperor just like the first. He wouldn't do it. He would change the Empire first. But he was having trouble remembering why that mattered. Jerry's face, desperate as she explained herself, haunted him. Which way to the coast? He asked. The gray horizon, swallowed up by the intimidating wall of fog, kept him from getting his bearings.
How am I supposed to know? Foster grumbled. I've got no idea where we are.
The instant Calder had stepped off his ship, he'd left orders for the Lyathaton to take the ship around to the back of the island. He had a feeling that they'd be making a hurried exit, and Urzaya had tracked his consultant target to the far side, away from the docks. The plan had been to reunite with him after meeting with the guild representatives. Calder knelt and placed a hand against the ground.
You think that rock has relevant information, sir? Andal asked.
On the surface, his tone was completely respectful. There was no intent invested in this rock whatsoever. It was as if no living humans had ever come this way.
but Calder had expected nothing else. He broadened his senses, reaching through the stone to the island as a whole, reading the aura of the Gray Island. The technique was of limited use under normal circumstances. He couldn't get any detailed visions from an object that large, and he certainly couldn't invest any intent into everything on the island. Reading such a broad area was like listening to a crowd of 1,000 people, all whispering their stories at once. But among those whispers, there were a few screams. Calder focused his attention on one such point of intense significance.
"Join with me," Nabarius whispers. "Tell me your secrets."
With power like this, he will be immortal. He will be unstoppable. He will be able to end all the fighting, on the island and in the entire world, and create a utopia. And overlaid over Nabarius, a second voice, chanting to an unheard rhythm.
"Rebirth, rebirth, join and be remade."
The thoughts held the same icy, nauseating, unspeakably old feel that he'd come to recognize as the signature of the dead mother. The heart of Nekothi was in Nabarius' possession. But that wasn't the only significant event on the island. In the distance, close to where the testament should soon be making landfall, a building filled with ancient purpose waited underground. In that arena, two figures did battle. One was Urzaya Woodsman, drawing on the strength of a sandborn hydra and carrying two hatchets that yearned to split his enemies in half. His intent felt like a collapsing mountain. Heavy, inevitable, and overwhelming. Calder couldn't imagine him losing. But his opponent, Calder didn't believe what he felt from her. She was a killer, no doubt, but she wasn't alone in her body. Where Urzaya was drawing on the power of a single chimera through his vessel, she was bursting with the fury of a dozen beasts. Strong wills tore at her muscles, pressed against the inside of her skin, and shredded her from the inside. The chimera within her seemed to fight each other as much as they fought Urzaya. Just from what he was feeling now, he couldn't understand why Urzaya's enemy hadn't torn herself apart. She seemed to be restraining all of those chimera with nothing more than the sheer force of her will. And if she ever succeeded into focusing that power into a single direction, no soulbound could stand a chance. Calder had to go help him. Just as Calder was going to break off the trance and end the reading, he caught a third shout among the crowd. Something was beginning. Close, only 100 yards behind Calder and a little below, the consultant prisoner was bending over a bronze blade. The weapon's lifetime stretches back through the entire history of the Empire. There is no life it can't take, no power it can't steal, no defense it can't break. And among others of its kind, this blade is unique. It has harvested lives of unimaginable significance, unfathomable depth. And Lucan needs it to do so again. He begs for every shred of power the blade can offer him. To protect Shara, he needs this knife to awaken. The trance broken, Calder snapped back to himself, staring up at Foster and Andal. The two of them looked away from him, weapons drawn, keeping an eye on the clearing while he gathered information. Now he was torn. Nabarius seemed to think that he could take control of the entire Gray Island if he succeeded in bonding with Nekothi's heart. Calder believed him. If the heart gave the chronicler any fraction of the Emperor's power, the Imperial Crown couldn't stand against him. But that was only if Nabarius could awaken it. Usually, awakening an object took time and strength in conjunction with the object's significance. Anything as substantial as a great elder's heart should take months to awaken and years to bond with. There was always the possibility that Nekothi herself was helping Nabarius along, and Calder had no idea what she was capable of. Still, he had more urgent threats than Nabarius. The blade behind him, for instance, was beginning to feel very dangerous. Calder wasn't sure what had changed to give Lucan the prisoner access to a consultant's blade. And if he had access to a weapon, why hadn't he broken free, especially as a reader? There was something about that situation that Calder didn't understand, which scared him. That was all happening next door to his wife, and although he had just abandoned her to her fate, he still couldn't help but worry about her safety. Lucan seemed to think that he was on the verge of awakening a deadly and powerful weapon, which he intended to pass on to Shara. If Calder could stop that, he wanted to, and he was closer to Lucan than to either of the other two. When in doubt, Sedesthenes said, seek first to preserve life. That wasn't Calder's favorite quote, but it seemed appropriate here. Rather than trying to pin down Nabarius or killing Lucan, supporting his crewmen came first, especially when it might result in a dead consultant assassin. Calder stood, adjusting his crown. Follow me, we're heading for Urzaya. Foster joined him without complaint, but Andal turned and swept his hat on his head, bowing to the spot where Calder had just knelt.
Thank you for the intelligence, Rock. We are in your debt.
Shut up and follow me.
468.
Jerry thought someone had returned to Lucan's cell, after which she heard the edges of a whispered conversation. However, when she asked him about it, he had denied receiving any visitors since Calder. In the moment, she decided to believe him. It didn't affect her anyway. She had more important things to worry about. For instance, she could once again feel the power of Nakothi in the air. The voice of the Great Elder, a voice she had learned to recognize since childhood, was screaming at her now to prostrate herself in the presence of superior power. It wanted to rebuild her, to remake her body so that she would be more acceptable to the dead mother. It was clearly the will of Nakothi, which meant that either the heart was getting closer or someone was trying to bring out its power. She pulled the band of iron off of her arm, focusing on it. The sleepless cabal had instructed her to use the object only when she felt the power of Nakothi wax. Was this it? The Great Elder was certainly getting stronger. Maybe she should have used it earlier. Or maybe this was one of those signals that she would know without a doubt as soon as she heard it.
475?
After only a moment of thought, Jerry grew frustrated at her own indecision. This wasn't like her. She didn't swing between possibilities like a broken weather vane, waiting until time made the decision for her.
500.
Suddenly resolute, Jerry sat down on her cot with her back against the wall, crossing her legs. She placed the iron band in her lap with one hand on either side. Closing her eyes, she focused her intent. She had used lesser summoning objects like this 3 times before, and none of them had been exactly alike. But she began the ritual she had been taught as a little girl.
I who remain awake must call to those in the dream. My power is lacking, and my wisdom is dim. In ignorance, I seek your light. In weakness, I seek your aid.
She waited a few seconds before continuing. The full sequence took about 3 minutes to successfully complete, and she would need to repeat it until it worked. Sometimes the Elder Spawn would arrive halfway through the first sequence, and other times it waited for 3 or 4 repetitions. She knew neither rhyme nor reason to the actions of the Elders. As she sat and chanted, she clung to one thought.
I wasn't at fault, Calder. I was right, and I can prove it. Just wait for me.
Calder stood inside what seemed to be a hollow boulder as another controlled consultant showed him the secret entrance to the arena. He knew that the structure waited beneath his feet. He could feel its heavy intent without making a particular effort. And the whole area shook as if under heavy blows, evidence of the battle going on underneath them. He, Foster, and Andal had wasted several minutes examining the exterior of the false boulder, finding nothing, before it occurred to Calder to shout for help. Driven by the power of the crown, the nearest consultant had stumbled out of the underbrush and begged to help. Get ready, Calder said, hefting his pistol. Urzaya's inside. They were now inside the massive fake boulder, which arched overhead. It shook around them, dust drifting down from the stone ceiling. Foster looked up at the shaking rock and snorted.
Oh, really? How could you tell?
Keen intuition and instinct. A roar echoed from somewhere under them.
I don't know where we'd be without your insight, Captain,
Andal said. At last, the consultant finally located the secret door, tracing its outlines in the cracks of the boulder's rough wall.
Here it is, but the lock should be...
He pushed lightly on it, and the door swung open.
It seems that we wasted our time looking for a hidden entrance,
Andal pointed out.
We should have just pushed on the rock.
I'll be sure to try that next time, Andal, Calder said. But until then... He motioned to the consultant, and Foster bound and gagged him in a few brief, skilled motions. From the fact that none of the other Crown-ordered consultants had returned, Calder gathered that the artifact's effect didn't last terribly long once he was out of sight. Then again, he hadn't ordered them to return unless they found Shara or the Heart of Nakothi. Maybe they had failed and found themselves without further instructions. Rather than a hallway, this secret entrance led down a ladder on the wall of a shaft that reminded him of a vertical sewer pipe. Foster didn't seem to mind, but it was Andal's turn to complain, grumbling about the slick walls ruining his suit. From all around them, the sounds of battle echoed, as though they had been stuck inside a drum. When they reached the bottom of the shaft, they stood on a ledge at the top of a tall staircase, looking out over a vast chamber. It looked as though someone had taken one of the great arenas of Azeria, made to seat 20 or 30,000 people, and transplanted it here, underneath the Grey Island. Calder briefly wondered how the island itself stayed together if its underbelly was made of such hollow chambers. The center of the arena was hardly the wide, sand-filled pit in which Calder had once found Urzaya. It looked like a maze. He was too far to make out details, but boxes and low walls and spiked poles littered the arena floor, arranged in some particular order that was lost on him. Of course, it would have been easier to identify the pattern if half of the obstacles weren't in ruins. As he watched, Urzaya swung a hatchet in an arc that sliced a pole in half. The blonde consultant vaulted over the attack, swinging a midair kick at the side of Urzaya's head. He blocked with his hide-wrapped forearm, sending up a crack that echoed all the way to Calder. Then he gathered his strength, driving his fist toward the consultant. She managed to duck the strike, leaving his punch to hit solid stone. The low wall cracked, shaking the entire arena.
"Praise the unknown god that we're here to help him," Andal said in a dry tone. "Quick, let's go rescue him from his mortal danger."
True, it didn't seem that Urzaya was in too much trouble, but the details from Calder's vision still troubled him. His cook was fighting with the power of a single chimera, focused into his soul-bound vessel. His opponent, on the other hand, fought with an army trapped inside her, and she didn't feel like a soul-bound at all. Somehow, she contained all that potential inside a single human body. If she pulled herself together, well, better to be safe. Urzaya wouldn't like it, but Calder was not above shooting a woman in the back. One of Yenzir's most famous quotes, "While honor has never won a single battle, deceit wins wars." Calder placed his foot on the top of the staircase, and the world vanished. He found himself dragged into a reader's trance like a leaf sucked into a tornado.
Nabarius runs through the island, clutching the oozing, gray-green heart to his chest. Its beat has grown stronger with time, pulsing in a rhythm with his own. It is almost bound to him, closer than his own limbs. Now the song guides him. He needs to stand in the right place at the right time to finish Nakothi's song. He spies a huge boulder, one that Calder knows to be hollow. There, just beyond that boulder, is a place.
"Here," the heart cries. "Here you will be remade."
Above him, Calder felt the power of the dead mother blazing cold like the fire of a dead star, but his vision did not yet return. The trance changed.
Lucan crouches in his cell, the bronze knife actually floating in the air in front of him. Sweat runs down his face, but he can't stop now. He finally realizes that he's been preparing for this moment for years. Everything he has done for Shara, everything that the two have shared, all of it has brought him to this moment. He shares a connection to her blade almost as deep as to his own. The pit is ready. The wood has been prepared. All it needs is a single spark to burst into flame.
Calder couldn't see the world around him, but he managed to speak. "Andal? Foster? I was wrong. We need to leave." They may have responded, but he couldn't tell. His senses were swallowed up once again.
"I will be reborn. I will remake this world. I will give my life and will receive life anew."
With a great effort, Nabarius brings all his intent to bear on the heart of Nakothi, striking a final, heavy hammer blow. In his cell, Lucan feels the life of the dagger taking shape, the fire beginning to flicker to life. Wisps of pale green light float around the blade, drifting like ghosts.
You are the taker of lives, the thief of secrets. You are that which turns power against power. You are the death of the powerful.
At the same instant, Calder saw a new vision, just a flash of something he hadn't sensed before.
Jirene sits in her own cell, only yards from Lucan. She holds in her hands a blighted circle of darkness, a twisted tool that seems to scream with anguish. But this scream will not bring aid. It is the squeal of prey that lures a predator. Jerry grips her artifact tight.
I call out to you, my elders, that you may hear my cry. Come to me.
Without warning, the vision shifted.
Nabarius raises the heart into the air.
I will be reborn.
And shifted again.
Lucan drives the blade into the ground.
You are called Siphron, the Whispering Death.
In Calder's mind, it was like three bombs exploding at once. The trance forcibly broke, leaving Calder to stumble. Andal cried out and grabbed him by the elbow, hauling him backwards before he dropped off the edge.
What just happened?
Foster asked, his voice shaken. Calder had almost forgotten. The gunner was a reader, too. All around them, air and earth trembled with the sound of a woman's laughter. Space twisted and distorted, shadows growing longer, trails of dust rising from the floor like wisps of smoke, and it was getting very cold.
We're leaving, now, Calder commanded, leaping up the ladder.
What about Uzziah?
Andal asked, though he followed close behind.
I'm afraid that an interruption would kill him. If he survives long enough, I'll come back for him.
He left unsaid that if they stayed on the island, all they could do was die alongside him. When they reached the top of the shaft, the three navigators ran desperately for the shore, Calder in the lead. They had only covered a few yards when they ran across Nabarius, laughing and dancing with the heart of Nakothi grasped in his left hand. He no longer looked anything like the polished imperial hero who had first shown himself on the Testament's deck. His hair was twisted and snarled, his face covered in scratches, and his eyes were wide with madness. His smile looked like a madman's grimace rather than a grin, and his red suit was shredded, the white shirt beneath splattered with gray-green blood. Andal and Calder pulled their guns, ready to fight, but Foster was faster. He clubbed Nabarius over the back of the head with the butt of his pistol. The chronicler staggered and turned on them in anger. He began to raise his hand, and Calder sensed the burning of his malicious intent. He had no idea what tricks Nabarius could perform now that he was a soulbound, and he had no intention of finding out. Foster hit him again, and this time Nabarius' eyes rolled up into their sockets. He fell on his chin, the heart of Nakothi tumbling from a limp hand.
Time was. I could have done that in one shot,
Foster said, shaking out the hand holding the pistol.
Must be getting old.
You shouldn't make a habit of hitting people over the head,
Andal advised.
You're more likely to kill them than to knock them senseless.
Oh, I'm aware.
Andal threw Nabarius over his shoulder, and Calder used the corner of his jacket to pick up the heart. Its malice seeped into him through the cloth, and he shuddered as he dumped it into his pocket. The last thing he wanted was to pick up a vision from a chunk of the dead mother's body. All around them, the inhuman laughter continued to echo unnaturally loud, rising into a shriek. As they continued to run, Andal carrying Nabarius over his shoulder and Calder trying not to think about the heart, Foster spoke.
I've been meaning to ask, but who's that laughing?
Nakothi,
Calder said, at the same time Andal said,
the dead mother.
Huh. Let's run a bit faster then, shall we?
Calder couldn't argue with that. The edge of the island wasn't far from the hidden entrance to the arena. It took them about 10 minutes of running to reach. On the few occasions that they ran into a consultant, Calder drove them away with the power of the Emperor's crown.
they looked across the blue expanse of the Aeon, and as he'd hoped, the familiar green-veined sails of the Testament bobbed just offshore, a shadow floating beneath the hull. But there wasn't much of a coast on this coast. The island terminated abruptly in a jagged row of rocks sticking up from the cliff like teeth in a lower jaw. Calder walked up, peering through the jagged stones to the sea below. As he'd feared, a sheer cliff, with nothing but more rocks and white surf beneath them. "It's possible this could pose a problem," he said. Andal walked up and took a look for himself, leaning over with Nabarius on his shoulder until it looked like he might dump the chronicler over. He didn't seem too concerned about the possibility.
"Can you call for a ride?"
Calder raised his hand purely for effect as he stretched out his mind to the Testament. He could sense the presence of his soul-bound vessel at this distance and could still call on its power to some degree. But steering the ship or raising the sails wouldn't help him now, and he could barely feel the Lyathaton at all. When Calder shook his head, the quartermaster was already moving along the edge, hostage on his shoulder.
"Move the ship," Andal said. "We'll meet it farther down the coast."
"It's my ship, and I think I'm the one who's supposed to give the orders."
"Then we await your orders, Captain."
"Very good, Andal." Calder sent a mental command to his vessel. "I've moved the ship. We should meet it farther down the coast."
"If you insist."
Andal had never stopped jogging in that direction. If anything, the distortions had grown stronger since they left the cavern. Air warped in the distance, like a heat haze, and bits of grass and soil tore themselves free from the ground and rose into the air. Rather than lifting straight upward, they seemed to be flying towards a point over the center of the island. And through it all, above it all, the dead mother's laughter rose to a screech.
"She laughs pretty good for a corpse," Foster panted.
The laughter sharpened to a squeal, like a sheet of metal tearing, but the sound was stretched into impossibility. Calder covered his ears with both hands, and still the sound made him feel as if his head would start bleeding. Andal stopped and tilted his hat back, staring up at the sky over the island.
"Light and life," he whispered.
A bright white dot appeared over the gray island, directly in the circle of sky between walls of gray. And from that spot, like roots pushing out from a seed, a nest of tentacles pushed out into the world. These weren't the limbs of an octopus or the dark green writhing appendages on shuffles. These tentacles were pale, the color of flesh, with bones visible through the tight skin. And instead of suction cups, the tendrils were covered in what seemed to be thousands of opening and closing hands. The tentacles lowered to the ground like the skirt of a dress settling, and more of the gigantic creature appeared from inside the white spot. Its torso was skeletally thin, a mottled white and blue and purple, as though it was covered in a bruise. Its arms came out next, multi-jointed and longer than trees, with hands that curled into claws. Its neck, too, looked unnaturally long, and when its head was revealed, Calder caught a brief glimpse of its head before he had to jerk away, taking deep breaths to avoid vomiting. The creature's head was a chaos of eyes, mouths, waving stalks, and cages of bone containing pulsing organs, parts that just should not be anywhere near a head. As a whole, the giant towered over the island, giving the impression of a skeletal woman with a writhing, living skirt and a gut-twisting, repulsive face. He had read of such creatures. Anyone who studied classical imperial history would have. Sidesthenes had spoken of them in his most famous history. Dread of aspect and thin of frame, I would have thought these creatures great elders themselves had I not received testimony from both the Emperor himself and the inimitable Esther Six. They are tapestries of flesh and nightmare, these handmaidens of Nakothi.
"Time to change plans again," Calder said, his voice high and panicked. "Let's jump."
"There is no chance we'd survive,"
Andal responded, still calm, though Calder noticed that he was looking directly away from the handmaiden.
"That thing isn't looking for us. Nothing has changed."
The handmaiden let out a bobbing whistle that sounded curiously similar to the dead mother's laughter from a few moments before. The white light above her expanded abruptly to the size of the moon, then shattered. The pieces, strangely, were tiny and black, and they scattered out like a parasol over the whole island. One of the pieces landed nearby like a meteorite, sending up a ring of dirt and dust. It raised itself from the crash, a hideously bloated bladder of fat squeezed between a set of external ribs. The monster hissed as it spotted them, waddling closer and raising a stone club in its single, oversized hand. Children of Nakothi, called to battle by their handmaiden. The gray island was now covered with them. Andal hurried for the edge.
The captain's right. Let's jump. You first, Nabarius.
He raised the unconscious chronicler's body and started to sling him over the edge, but Calder stopped him. His mind boiled furiously, just as if he were frantically looking for an advantage in the middle of a negotiation. There had to be something he could use to get out of this, something that would give him the edge he needed, something that he'd saved for just such an occasion. An idea struck him, and his hand shot to the vile organ in his jacket pocket. Gripping it felt like holding a slimy bundle of dead cockroaches and rotting garbage. He had to force himself to keep touching it for longer than an instant. Its song eroded the edges of his mind, prying at his reader's senses, looking for a gap to worm its way in and drive him insane. It was so much more powerful than when they'd first arrived. It would find a way in, if he gave it the time. Good thing he didn't need to hold it for long. Hopping up on one of the rocks, Calder pitched the heart of Nakothi off the cliff and into the sea. Chapter 24. There were no great elders more widely respected than Kalarak, whose name means collector of souls. In legend and myth, he has the reputation of a shrewd bargainer whose deals more often than not spell doom for the other party. The common understanding, in this case, comes close to historical fact. Though no man but the Emperor remembers Kalarak's true shape, records of his rule still exist. Kalarak was the only known great elder without a specific domain, wandering as he did among the territories of his brothers and sisters. He gathered his power from humans, granting their wishes in exchange for an item of value. Invested artifacts, personal allegiance, stolen relics of the other elders, even blood or sanity. Kalarak is chained to a drowned city somewhere beneath the Aeon, but reports of his activity continue throughout the centuries. Contemporary legend suggests that one may summon his attention in the same way that one summons a lesser elder spawn, namely through focused application of intent. However, any plea for Kalarak's attention first requires a sacrifice. An object, valuable to you, tossed into the Aeon where his minions can retrieve it. There is no guarantee that such a sacrifice will warrant Kalarak's attention, only that without it, you may be assured of summoning only his apathy. To survive a bargain with the Soul Collector, one must be exceptionally clever and exceptionally desperate. Arthur Belfry, Imperial Witness, in a confidential report commissioned by the Black Watch. 11 years ago. Calder drifted in a sea of frozen darkness, blood leaking into the water around him. The rest of his body was numb with the cold, so it didn't seem fair that his cut hand still burned. Still, from everything he'd learned among the Black Watch, the wound was necessary. He didn't know much about summoning elders, but between the blood and the pain and his own impending death by hypothermia, he imagined that he was presenting a feast to every dangerous predator in the whole of the Aeon Sea. Any elder that couldn't sense this was blind, deaf, and not worth his attention. Just like Alsa Greyweather had tried for almost 2 years, Calder cast his intent into the water, summoning elder spawn.
Come to me. I summon thee. Someone help.
Readers required only focus of intent, not speech. Technically, it wasn't necessary to imagine speaking in order to invest an object, but every reader that Calder had ever met used words to focus their thoughts. This time, Calder didn't fully understand the summons, so he hoped the clarity of his desperation would make up for what he lacked in specificity.
Whoever you are, come now. I require your power.
It was easier than Calder had expected. One second he floated in freezing black, the next he sat on a low couch next to a blazing fire. He was dry and warm, resting in a sitting room straight out of the ancient empire. The walls were monuments of polished stone, supported by intricately carved columns. Every entrance was a doorless arch, and the walls were padded with tapestries, just as the floor was lined with brightly patterned carpets. He should have been startled by the abrupt transition, but he was mostly just relieved. Encounters with elders were supposed to be nightmarish and dramatic, not plush and comfortable. If this was the typical experience of a summoner, then he should try this more often. Calder leaned forward, warming the remembered chill from his fingertips, when suddenly a voice spoke from next to the fire.
Welcome, Calder Martin. Those who knock at my door are too often misers, but you have left me such gifts.
He looked to the right, only slightly surprised to see a man seated where a moment ago had only been empty space. The man reminded Calder of no one so much as the Emperor. He had the dark skin of a full-blooded Heartlander, as well as the poise of aristocratic upbringing, and he had draped himself in shiny fabrics. A robe of cloth of gold was embroidered with a climbing serpent and closed with an orange sash. Jeweled rings flashed on every finger, layers of necklaces fanned over his chest, and loops of gold hung from his ears. He was not hairless, as the Emperor seemed to be. The hair on his head was trimmed short, his beard limited to a thin goatee. But by far his most remarkable features were his eyes, or rather, the device that covered them. A band of some silver metal encircled his whole head, with bolts where his eyes should have been. It was as though someone had fashioned him a steel blindfold and then bolted it into his sockets. Calder stopped staring at the man, looking for any similarity to Shuffles, and tried to recall his previous comment. Gifts. Calder had no idea what gifts he was talking about, but he wasn't going to expose his ignorance at the very beginning of a negotiation. He gave his best smile, though he didn't know if the man could see it.
Of course, I would not send out such an invitation without something to welcome you.
The man spread his hands like a salesman demonstrating his wares, and suddenly a table appeared on the floor before him. Spread out on the surface of the table, arranged on cushions of velvet, were six simple objects. Objects that Calder recognized. One, a small hammer that he had invested to break stone. Another, a spool of thread invested to bind a man's hands and feet. They were his contingency tools, packed to help break his father out of prison and abandoned in Candle Bay when they proved themselves unnecessary.
I must say, it was unwise of you to send such a message so broadly, the man said. There are others of my siblings with holdings in the sea, and none of them so generous as I.
Then I am greatly pleased that my call reached your ears. What may I call you, sir?
The man smiled, revealing a pair of teeth capped in gold.
I was once called the father of merchants, the lord of coin. The gambler's delight, they named me, and miser's bane. I was the keeper of the vaults, the hoard gatherer, the seeker of treasures. Now, I believe, men call me Kelarak.
Kelarak,
Calder repeated, his mouth suddenly dry. Kelarak licked his lips as though tasting the word.
Kelarak, is that how it is said these days? Human language changes so quickly. It is a name I favored, though. Collector of souls.
He rubbed his hands together, a man expecting a feast.
What have you come to purchase with your soul, Calder Martin?
Calder felt like he had slid a foot out on thin ice, only to find out that there was no ice at all, only deep, dark seas filled with hungry sharks.
Tread carefully, Calder. Whatever you do, don't mess this up.
If he focused his intent any harder, his brain might burst into flames.
I apologize for bothering you, Lord Kalarak,
Calder said, with an attempt at a seated bow.
I was seeking a lesser member of your entourage.
Kalarak adjusted the steel band over his eyes like a man fiddling with his spectacles.
caught a bigger fish than you expected, did you? If that is the case, I will be more than satisfied to take your gifts and walk away. I will simply throw myself back.
He started to rise, but Calder threw out a hand to stop him.
Please wait just a moment, Lord Calorak. It's possible that we can come to some sort of an arrangement.
Calorak seated himself once more, plucking a grape from thin air and pushing it into his mouth.
You have purchased my attention, reader of memory.
Two of my companions and I are trapped on some rocks in Candle Bay. A number of armed men are closing in around us. I had hoped to call something big enough to carry us to shore.
That was what the Black Watch were trying to do with the Testament, after all. Summon something that could drag a whole ship through the ocean. If he called a creature that wouldn't or couldn't listen to reason, well, he still had his seven nails. Calorak laughed, and it was surprisingly ordinary. The room didn't shake like an earthquake, and Calder didn't feel his brain dribbling out his ears. It was the laugh of a man hearing an amusing story.
I did not realize you were so young, Calder Martin, even for one of your kind. I doubt you understand how improbable your survival was.
I'm beginning to, he said honestly.
Yes, I think you are.
Calorak stroked his short beard, deliberating.
I have a servant in your area who might serve you well. Yes, very well indeed. But there is, of course, the matter of price.
Calder nodded to the invested odds and ends displayed on the table.
Those are quality work. They represent months of my time and intent. Surely they are valuable enough to warrant this one small task.
Behind the metal blindfold, Calorak's eyebrows raised.
These are the gifts you offer for the pleasure of my hospitality. If you wish to make a transaction with me, then I require something more substantial.
Not my soul, Calder said quickly.
Painful as it was to die in Candle Bay, he didn't want that fate hanging over his afterlife. Calorak waved one jeweled hand.
What is a soul? Despite the name I was given by men, I do not understand souls. I like the title because soul collector implies that I own humans in their entirety. Minds, bodies, service, these things I understand.
Was it worth living if it meant servitude to a nameless elder beneath the sea?
If it means Jerry and my father go free, then yes. How much of my service might this cost me?
Calorak laughed again.
I collect whole objects, reader of memory, not pieces. To that end, I require something else that I believe is in your possession. A small copper key.
Calder's mind flashed to the Emperor's key. Jerry had it, which meant it should be in his coat.
You have a deal,
Calder said quickly, before the Elder could change his mind. He patted down the pockets of the coat until he located the key, holding it out for Calorak. The Great Elder